Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Rescuers search for survivors in Turkey mine blast. And judge orders Pistorius to undergo psychiatric evaluation. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. Rescuers in western Turkey are searching for survivors after an electrical explosion and fire at a coal mine killed at least 238 people in one of the country's worst mining accidents. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan told reporters Wednesday that 120 workers are believed to still be trapped. Mr. Erdogan postponed an international trip and traveled to the mine in the Turkish town of Soma, south of Istanbul, where he met with authorities handling rescue operations, as well as with grieving family members. Officials say 787 people were inside the mine at the time of the blast, and that 363 of them were rescued. Turkish President Abdullah Gül has ordered the Manisa governor to mobilize all available resources to help rescue the miners. Ukraine is hosting national unity talks Wednesday, a day after pro-Russian separatists killed seven Ukrainian soldiers in an ambush of a military armored column near the eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk. The talks are part of a plan laid out by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, national lawmakers, and regional offices are attending, but separatist rebels are not part of the talks. Tuesday's Kramatorsk attack came as Germany's foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, traveled to Ukraine to push for a negotiated solution to the country's crisis. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department released satellite pictures showing Russian forces near the Ukrainian border, despite assurances from Moscow last week that it had withdrawn its huge military force. A South African judge has ordered runner Oscar Pistorius to undergo psychiatric tests, bringing a stop to his trial on charges he murdered his girlfriend at his home last year. The judge announced a ruling Wednesday following testimony this week from a defense witness who said Pistorius had an anxiety disorder that causes fear and worry. Prosecutor Gary Nell requested the tests. He says he does not want Pistorius to use such a condition as the basis for a possible appeal later on. The judge said Wednesday the tests are to make sure Pistorius gets a fair trial and that he may be evaluated on an outpatient basis. She will give the full details of the order when the court reconvenes next Tuesday. If convicted, Oscar Pistorius could face life in prison. Negotiators from Iran and a group of six world powers are holding a new round of talks in their effort to craft a long-term agreement on Iran's nuclear program. In the final agreement, Iran wants all sanctions targeting its nuclear program lifted, while the group that includes the United States, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany wants assurances that Iran is not working to build nuclear weapons. Iran has long insisted its nuclear program is peaceful. The Philippines says China is developing land on a disputed reef in the hotly contested Spratly Islands of the South China Sea. From Manila, Simone Orondine reports.
A spokesman for the Department of National Defense confirms that early this year, military surveillance found China involved in earth-moving activities in the area of Johnson South Reef. The reef is more than 300 kilometers west of Palawan Province in the Philippines. The Philippine Department of Foreign Affairs says it lodged a protest with China early last month over its reclamation of Johnson South Reef. In a statement, the ministry said China rejected the protest and President Benigno Aquino raised the issue at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit in Burma over the weekend. Simone Orendine, Manila.
Chinese police have accused a British executive of drug maker GlaxoSmithKline of heading up a scheme to bribe doctors and hospitals. Police say senior GSK Vice President Mark Riley ordered his staff to pay hundreds of millions of dollars in bribes to help promote sales. Riley is the first foreign employee to be accused of a crime during the 10-month investigation into the London-based company. Two Chinese executives were also accused Wednesday of working with Riley to bribe officials. That's the news from The Voice of America. I'm Bob Doty reporting.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigerian activists say the kidnapping of more than 300 schoolgirls in the north a month ago was no isolated incident. The abduction of women and girls in Nigeria is a much larger problem, they say, and kidnappers are almost never punished.
That's VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also in the news, in Nigeria's Borno State, vigilantes successfully defend a small town from a Boko Haram attack yesterday. And UNICEF's representative to the Central African Republic says children have fallen victim to malnutrition and recruitment as child soldiers.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny Young, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
In Nigeria's Borno State, vigilantes successfully defended a small town in Kalabage administrative district from a Boko Haram attack yesterday. The vigilantes are part of a growing movement in northern Nigeria, where the Nigerian army and police have failed to stop Boko Haram attacks on towns, villages, and schools. Locally, the Home Guards are known as Civilian Joint Task Forces. Yesterday, members of the Kalabage Joint Task Force attacked armed insurgents who were preparing to attack in two pickup trucks. Security officials said the vigilantes, armed with rocks, clubs, and bows and arrows, killed an undetermined number of insurgents and turned 10 others over to army authorities. Kalabage is about 155 miles north of Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State. Many such civilian groups often offer support at military checkpoints to identify suspected Boko Haram militants.
Nigerian activists say the kidnapping of more than 300 schoolgirls in the north a month ago was not an isolated incident. The abduction of women and girls in Nigeria is a much larger problem, they say, and kidnappers are almost never punished. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
A protest of a couple of hundred people in the Nigerian capital on Tuesday got heated after Borno State Governor Kashim Shettima spoke. A month after the girls were kidnapped from Borno, Islamist militants known as Boko Haram are holding more than 250 in a forest hideout. Shettima explained part of the reason the girls are still missing.
In an insurgency operation like we are currently undergoing, it's the terrorists that are setting the pace of the war. There are people who know the terrain very well. They are the ones who are setting the agenda. So naturally, they tend to have the upper hand.
He says the abduction of the girls from Chibok town last month was not the first time Boko Haram has attempted to kidnap large groups of children from their schools. It was just the first time they were not stopped. Borno residents say Boko Haram has long been kidnapping women and girls and forcing them to be their so-called wives. The group says it wants to install its harsh version of Islamic law in Nigeria. But some analysts say its operations appear to be geared more towards wanton destruction than imposing an ideology. Outside the governor's office, some activists say the kidnapping is part of a larger problem in Nigeria, where the abduction of women and girls goes largely unpunished. Actress Dorothy Njamanzi narrowly escaped abduction in Abuja 2 years ago after she was beaten and molested.
Now we're here talking about another spate of abductions because other spates of abductions were not spoken against. They were encouraged by the government's silence, and now we have yet another dimension to abductions. Honestly, my heart is broken.
Kidnapping is also on the rise again in the Niger Delta, an oil-rich region in the south, where militants have risen up against oil companies and the government several times, says lawyer Phyllis Obasahan. In his office in Wari, a rundown oil city, Obasahan says kidnapped victims in the Niger Delta tend to be adults taken for ransom. But he says the problem continues for much the same reason as in the north. Even when the kidnappers are caught and arrested, they are hardly ever convicted, he says.
There are a few ones on trial, but for conviction, there has not been really a strong one.
Other activists demanding the rescue of the girls agree, but they say at this point they're not concerned with what happens after the girls are freed. Media coordinator Rotimi Olaole is with the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, a loose coalition of activist groups organizing rallies online and on the streets, demanding the safe return of the girls.
What we want the most is that our girls come out alive, and after that we're ready to work and support government to ensure that this do not happen again, and that abductions are reduced to the barest minimum.
Boko Haram released a video this week that included more than 100 kidnapped girls wearing Muslim headscarves. The man who claims to lead Boko Haram, Abubakar Shekau, says in a separate scene in the video, he converted the girls to Islam and is willing to trade them for the return of some of his imprisoned members. On Wednesday, the government reiterated that it will explore all options for the release and safe return of the girls. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
A new report finds a record 33.3 million people were internally displaced by conflict and violence in 2013, a staggering increase of 4.5 million from the previous year. The report by the Norwegian Refugee Council notes sub-Saharan Africa has the largest total number of IDPs, followed by the Middle East and North Africa. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report by the Norwegian Refugee Council notes about two-thirds of the 33.3 million internally displaced people are in just five countries: Syria, Colombia, Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Sudan. This is the first time Nigeria is included in these global statistics, and the report documents 3.3 million Nigerians displaced within their own country. The Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, Jan Egeland, says that number includes nearly half a million driven from their homes during 2013.
Of the 470,000 displaced in Nigeria last year, about 300,000 were displaced due to Boko Haram, the conflict between Boko Haram and counter-insurgency forces, and violence from Boko Haram. 170,000 displaced by intercommunal strife in Nigeria. 470,000 altogether.
The report says Syria has the highest total of IDPs, 6.5 million. Egeland calls Syria the epicenter of violent forced displacement. Every day, 9,500 people, about one family every 60 seconds, is being displaced in Syria. Egeland cites the Central African Republic as another exploding crisis, with nearly 1 million people newly displaced. He also points to South Sudan, where 380,000 people became displaced in 2013, and the total now has reached 1 million. Egeland says people who are displaced in their own countries are in a state of absolute crisis. Because they have not crossed the border, they are not entitled to the same international protections afforded refugees. He says they are unprotected, extremely vulnerable, and very often lack assistance. He says the figures in the report are the worst since the international community began recording internally displaced figures in 1989.
It is worse than the bleakest and blackest hours of the 1990s, with the genocides in Bosnia, elsewhere on the Balkans, and in Rwanda and in the Congo. At that time, it peaked around 28 million. Then we have had a decrease. We're now talking 1995, 96. Since 2000, there has been a relentless increase in the number of internally displaced. But the last 2 years have been by far the worst.
Egeland says he fears the number of people fleeing their homes will continue to escalate. He says nations must work more closely together to end this misery for millions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Nigeria's Borno State, vigilantes successfully defended a small town from a Boko Haram attack yesterday. A new report finds a record 33.3 million people were internally displaced by conflict and violence in 2013. And UNICEF's representative to the Central African Republic says children have fallen victim to malnutrition and recruitment as child soldiers. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
UNICEF's representative to the Central African Republic says children have fallen victim to malnutrition and recruitment as child soldiers. He warns the conflict has growing regional implications. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Suleiman Diabate was in New York this week briefing UN officials about the ongoing crisis. He says all of the country's health and social services have collapsed.
The situation in Central African Republic is not good at all. It is a fragile country, and the security situation is volatile and unpredictable. So working in this environment is kind of complicated.
A complicated situation grew even worse last December when Christian militias formed to combat attacks by mostly Muslim Seleka rebels. The intercommunal violence has left many civilians dead or maimed. Much of the country's Muslim population has been displaced from the capital, Bangui. About 6,000 African and French peacekeepers are trying to maintain a semblance of order in a country too big for their numbers. The UN has authorized a mission to the country, MINUSCA, consisting of 10,000 military and 1,800 police personnel. But it'll be months before they arrive.
We all know that the peacekeeping mission will be deployed in mid-September, but we all know that the mission won't be fully operational in September. So between now and September, there is a kind of vacuum that needs to be addressed.
Diabate says in the meantime, the current troops on the ground need to be better organized and better equipped. He says unless the world pays attention to CAR, neighboring countries, such as Chad, Cameroon, DRC, and South Sudan, could face long-term negative effects, including refugees and spillover fighting.
We hear more about Syria, we hear more about Philippines or Ukraine, but CAR is not getting enough resources to address the issue of the children in Central African Republic.
Schools in the country have been closed for more than a year.
Children are not going to school, so they are being recruited by the rebels, by the militia groups. Children are being recruited by force, or sometimes they are joining because for them it is the only way to find food. It is the only way to find a way to take care of themselves.
The UN agency has managed to get some of the child soldiers released. It set a goal of freeing 1,500 child soldiers this year. Last year, UNICEF vaccinated 400,000 children in CAR against measles, yellow fever, and polio. The target is to immunize more than 700,000 children against measles in 2014.
We have also the case of malnourished children. We have a lot of malnourished children due to the crisis, because when the crisis happened, families were living in the bush. In the pediatric hospital of Bangui, the sole pediatric hospital we have for the entire country, the number of malnourished children has tripled.
Diabate says UNICEF has increased the number of personnel in the country from 70 to 200. They have access, he says, to most of the country except the far north.
Central African Republic is a donor orphan country. We have launched the Humanitarian Action for Children for $81 million, but we have mobilized only 20%. So there is a gap which needs to be filled up.
Diabate says in briefing UN officials about the crisis, he is echoing the voices of the children of CAR. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
International Organization for Migration, IOM, has just completed a significant relief effort to internally displaced persons, IDPs, in Northern Central African Republic. It has distributed an estimated 13.7 tons of food to some 1,400 new arrivals in Cabo and Moyenceto. The distribution focused on the recently relocated PK-12 community. It's a Muslim and minority population that had come under attack in the capital, Bangui, and decided to relocate to northern CAR. Included in the assistance package was a one-month emergency supply of rice, beans, oil, salt, and Super Cereal Plus. The IOM will arrange another food distribution in the coming weeks. Sandra Black is the communications officer for the IOM in Bangui. She spoke with me about when the distribution started, as well as the present humanitarian conditions in the CAR.
The food distribution took place in Cabo Thursday and then continued on in Moyenceto on the CAR-Chad border over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday.
And what is the security situation like at this time?
The security situation continues to be unstable in Central African Republic. The population that we're feeding, the recently relocated population, is from PK-12. The neighborhood in northern Bangui, it's a community of Muslims and ethnic minorities who are being attacked. They're surrounded by anti-Balaka militia. So the UN humanitarian coordinator made a decision that this population needed to be moved north. The population was given a choice of where they wanted to go. Two of the locations were Cabo and Moyenceto. So humanitarian community provided transportation for them to be on the border near Chad, where they feel safer.
These two communities are mixed communities with Muslims and Christians. So how was the convoy received by the communities?
The communities very warmly received the convoy. The mayor in Cabo did a lot of sensitization with the community. So in the church, in the mosque, they were told that this community was coming and they were very excited to receive them. Many people from PK-12 were being reunited with their families in Cabo and Moyenceto. So there were people there to greet them and hug them upon arrival. The humanitarian community has been working hard to prepare the site for the PK-12 people who were relocated. So there were tents built and food was provided in this distribution a few days after their arrival.
What will the long-term situation be regarding housing for the IDPs?
Humanitarian organizations will continue to assist this population. Right now they're in tents, but infrastructure assistance will be provided for them to make this their home if they choose to. The mayor of Cabo decided that the site should be named, given a name of the neighborhood, so it would be part of Cabo. It's not just the displacement site. It's somewhere that these people can make their home.
I also understand the mayor of Cabo offered to the IDPs that they would be able to farm. Is that correct?
That's true. The mayor offered more than 80 plots to PK-12 community members to warmly welcome them and give them a chance to build their livelihoods agriculturally in Cabo.
At this point, how many IDPs are there total in CAR?
There are more than 500,000 IDPs in CAR. It's a number that often fluctuates. In Bangui, the number has gone down. We had more than 500,000 at the end of December. And in Bangui, the capital, that has gone down to less than 150,000. But around the country, there's still more than 500,000 and estimated more than 1 million who have already fled the country.
That was Sandra Black, a communications officer for the International Organization for Migration. She spoke with me from Bangui.
In yet another dramatic twist in the Oscar Pistorius murder trial, the judge granted a request the athlete be committed to a psychiatric facility for 30 days observation. A psychiatrist claimed he was suffering from general anxiety disorder that may have influenced his actions. The move suspends his trial for allegedly murdering his girlfriend at his Pretoria home last year. VOA's Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
Both sides in Oscar Pistorius's murder trial have spent weeks poring over every detail of what happened on February 14, 2013. They've spent hours going over the placement of bullet holes in the locked bathroom door through which the runner fired four shots, killing his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp. They have reached back into his life story, the amputation of his legs shortly after birth, his ascendance to being the first double amputee to compete in the Olympics in 2012, and that same year, meeting the woman he fell in love with and then killed. But the main factor, both sides agree, is something no one can see: the inner workings of his mind. What Pistorius was thinking that night is the critical difference between guilt and innocence in this murder trial. Pistorius argues his disability makes him feel vulnerable and constantly fearful. He says it was that fear that drove him to fire blindly at the locked bathroom door, where he thought an intruder was hiding. He says he did not mean to shoot Reva Steenkamp. The prosecution argues he meant to kill. Earlier in the week, a witness for the defense, a psychiatrist, testified that the athlete's anxiety disorder may have played a role in his actions. That claim prompted the prosecutor, Harry Nell, to essentially ask for a second opinion. On Wednesday, Judge Tokozila Masipa agreed, essentially ordering the court to get deeper into his mind.
The question is whether there was a reasonable possibility that a referral of the accused for observation in terms of Section 79 of Act 51 of 1977 would reveal inter alia that at the time the crime was committed, the accused suffered from a mental disorder which could have resulted in his not being criminally responsible for his act. Having regard to the facts of this case, I'm persuaded that the requirement of a reasonable possibility has been met.
Masipa will release a more detailed ruling on Tuesday, which will include logistical details. The move will then delay the trial for at least 1 month. Law professor James Grant of the University of the Witwatersrand says the psychiatrist's claim of possible mental illness forces the court to further examine the claim. But he says he does not think the psychiatric observation will find that Pistorius's mental illness is a contributor to his actions. He says the so-called insanity defense claim may actually help the prosecution.
The referral will, in my view, probably come to nothing, but I think it's going to force the defense to clarify what exactly their defense is. And that is very positive for the prosecution, because it's then able to focus on disproving the defense. At the moment, the defense is effectively raising a moving target.
In the course of this trial, the runner has shown a range of extreme emotional reactions, sobbing and even vomiting into a bucket during graphic testimony. But Wednesday, he remained stoic. In the past 2 years, he has made a journey that no one expected, from the Olympics to the trial dock and now to a psychiatric ward. The next turn will be revealed when the trial resumes. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yisroel in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In Nigeria's Borno State, vigilantes successfully defended a small town from a Boko Haram attack yesterday. A new report finds a record 33.3 million people were internally displaced by conflict and violence in 2013. And UNICEF's representative to the Central African Republic says children have fallen victim to malnutrition and recruitment as child soldiers. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and in our feature segment, the third part of our series on alternative beliefs in South Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young today. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
Well, what's going on in soccer today?
Well, Kim, we start off with soccer. Thanks very much. With less than a month to Brazil 2014, Ivory Coast coach Sabri Lamouche has selected the vastly experienced 28-man Provisional World Cup squad. Striker Didier Drogba, capped 99 times, spearheads the so-called Golden Generation, who will have a last chance to grab glory in Brazil. Brothers Yaya and Kolo Touré are joined by fellow Premier League best stars Cheke Toite and Wilfred Bonny. Forward Lassina Traore has been included, despite suffering an injury-ravaged loan spell at Everton. Lamouche will have until June 2nd to decide whether to gamble on Traore and include him in the final 23-man cut. The Elephants will face Colombia, Greece and Japan in Group C, which appears to be a much easier draw than in their two previous appearances at the tournament. Unlucky 2006 and 2010 group draws resulted in the West Africans finishing third behind Argentina and Netherlands in Germany and third behind Brazil and Portugal in South Africa. Meanwhile, reports from Rwanda say the Federation of Rwanda Football Association has offered Briton Steven Constantine a two-year deal to become their new national team coach. The federation needs a successor to Eric Nshimiyimana, whose contract ends on July 31st. The 51-year-old Constantine is a former Millwall first-team coach and has experience in African football, having managed Malawi from February 2007 to April 2008. According to media reports, Constantino is expected to hold discussions with the Rwanda Federation on Thursday, and he holds a UEFA pro license and has managed the national sides of Nepal, India, Malawi, and Sudan.
VOA! I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is www.facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, www.facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America.
And in more sports soccer news, African football fans are looking forward to a big weekend of qualifying matches for next year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Morocco. VOA Sunny Young asked our African football guru, David Legg, for a preview.
The Africa Cup of Nations 2015, which will be hosted by Morocco, who, of course, automatically qualified because they're staging the tournament, it's been divided basically into two sections. You've got a preliminary round, which is home and away, two-leg knockout ties. And then later in the year, in September, October, November, you'll have the group stage, and that's where the giants like Nigeria, Ghana, and Ivory Coast will come into play. If we look at this weekend, Sonny, four matches on Saturday and nine matches on Sunday. There's quite a lot of interest in these matches, so let me go through them quickly. The ones on Saturday, we got Mauritania against Equatorial Guinea. Now, Mauritania are interesting in that they had to play the only first round preliminary round match, and they beat Mauritius home and away. And they could be a team to watch. I've mentioned previously on the Sunny Side of Sport, Equatorial Guinea will be favourites, but I fancy Mauritania could upset them. In Windhoek, you've got Namibia against Congo-Brazzaville. I think the Congolese over the two legs should be the stronger side. You've got Sao Tome at Principe against Benin. And then in Blantyre, you've got Malawi and Chad. And the Chadians can't be looking forward to this, Sonny. They've met the Malawians in the two previous qualifying competitions and they've come off second best. Then we move on to Sunday, and a big hello to all our listeners in Liberia. And they'll be looking forward to the match in Monrovia between Liberia and Lesotho. A warm welcome, too, to all our listeners in Kenya and in Nairobi. It'll be Kenya against the Comore Islands. And that is certainly a tie the Kenyan Harambee Stars should win with a few goals to spare. Out in the Indian Ocean in Antananarivo, it's Madagascar against Uganda. Unfortunately, Libya against Rwanda, Sonny, has had to be switched from Libya because of the ongoing security problems there. And that match will be played in a suburb of the Tunisian capital, Tunis. In Bujumbura, it's Burundi against Botswana. Another fixture, unfortunately, that has had to be moved for security reasons. Central African Republic, who have home advantage over Guinea-Bissau, they will now play that match in the Congolese capital, Brazzaville, because of the very sad situation in the Central African Republic. Certainly out of the question at the moment for football to be staged in Bangui, the capital. In Lubumba, in Swaziland, it's Swaziland against Sierra Leone. And then, to me, a really attractive pairing in Dar es Salaam. It's Tanzania against Zimbabwe. And in Maputo, South Sudan, the youngest nation in the world, will make their Cup of Nations debut away to Mozambique. The return matches, Sonny, are scheduled for May 30, 31 and June 1. And also a reminder that the Seychelles have received a walkover because Gambia have been barred from all CAF competitions for 2 years over age cheating. They fielded five overage players in an African Youth Championship match against Liberia. CAF detected this and they've taken action, which I fully support.
That's our African football guru, David Legg. Turning to athletics, Cuthbert Nyasango recently set a Zimbabwe national record at the Volkswagen Prague Marathon in the Czech Republic. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Cuthbert after his third-place finish. Here is Andy.
We're talking with a man who's just broken the Zimbabwe record in the marathon, and that is Cuthbert Nyasango, who's finished in a very fine third place in the Volkswagen Prague Marathon. 2:09:52 is the new national record for Zimbabwe. Cuthbert, clearly, it's a happy day for you. Just look back on the last couple of years as well, because you were ninth in the Olympic marathon in London. That was a very good performance, but maybe you had a few problems after that. So this is really perhaps coming good again in Prague for you.
Yeah, I'm very happy with number 3. I was so surprised with myself when I saw myself at 33 and I'm number 4. I just tell myself, okay, Lord, take me home. I think I'm almost there. It's only 9Ks to go. And then I continue pushing because my program was very well. I did my times very well. I was doing good in training. Even my tune-up races were good. I was running almost 63 of two of them. So I'm very confident about my training, but I was aiming at 2:09, 2:08, which I got 2:09. So I'm very happy with my time and what I've done for the previous 5 months.
Was it a long time game plan to break the national record of Zimbabwe? Tendai Chimosasa running just outside 2:10, and that stood for a long time, 1998.
Yeah, it was my goal because me and Chimosasa was my role model when I started running. And since I started running, I've been breaking his records. So I was aiming to run fast than what he did, and I did today. So I'm very happy with that, and then I'll continue to aim for more higher goals.
Well, you certainly did. Give your assessment. This was your debut in Prague. It's not the easiest of courses. There's about 8-9 kilometers of cobbles. A lot of support out there on the course. A lot of fans out there, but it's not one of the easiest courses of the marathon to run, is it?
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, only the cobblestone, I think there's a problem, but generally the course is okay. There's not too much hills. Then it's fast. Only today, I think, unfortunately, there was a little bit of windy, but I think the course is, it's not that very bad like Boston, but it's okay. It's quite good.
London Olympics, the marathon, you did really well. 9th place, and there's nothing to beat the Olympic marathon, obviously. How did your career go after London? Did you have problems or was it smooth sailing?
Well, I had a lot of problems just after London. I ran one half marathon. After that, I got injured. I back in problem. And then I ran in Fukuoka with a big injury. Then from there, it was a year of problems. The whole last year, I didn't run very well. Since then, it was only physios, rest, physios, exercises to make sure that I recover very well. And then I started to carve around November, December, and then I started to train for this marathon around December.
So everything's really come good, and that's a great note, I think, to finish on and say congratulations, Cuthbert. Zimbabwe record, third place in the Volkswagen Prague Marathon, and I'm sure Prague would look forward to seeing you again, maybe getting even further higher up on the podium. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's Andy Edwards reporting from Prague. Now, for more athletics news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Amaka Ouma.
Nigeria's Africa Youth 100-meter champion Divine Odudoru clocked 10.39 seconds to maintain his winning form at the Athletics Federation of Nigeria Golden League meeting in Akure, Ondo State, Southwest Nigeria. Patience Okon won women's 400 meters in 52.20 seconds. On the infield, former Africa Junior champion Nkechi Nchime triumphed in women's shot put with a heave of 14.86 meters. Daramola Feisayo won the women's hammer with a throw of 58.56 meters, while Nigerian Police and National Security and Civil Defense Corps won the men's and women's 4x100-meter relays in 39.44 seconds and 45.72 seconds, respectively. Meanwhile, All Africa Games bronze medalist Kurt Kuto is Mozambique's best hope for a medal at the Africa Senior Athletics Championships in Marrakesh, Morocco, in August. He confirmed his fitness with a clear win in 400-meter hurdles in 49.56 seconds at the South Africa Open Athletics Championships in Tlokwe. Kuto admits there is room for improvement.
Today's race was, time-wise, it was good. Technically, a bit shaky over the last few hurdles. But nevertheless, like you said, Mark, sub-50, the last time I ran a sub-50 was in 2012. The whole of last year I was injured, so I'm glad to be back amongst the quick times.
Technically, you had that problem at the Africa Championships when you were a medal contender. We've now got another African Championships in Morocco this time. What are you going to do around this technical thing? Because by your own admission, there are certain technical areas you need to put right.
Well, back in 2012, I'm not going to say they tripped me, but the eventual winner hit his hurdle and he came in my lane, and that's when I hit his hurdle and I fell. Now that African champs are back this year and it's a World Cup year, I think we just have to train harder and make sure we go for gold there.
Now remember that since Maria Mutola retired, you are the one holding the mantle of the Mozambican athletes. You're the only medalist at the All Africa Games when it was in Maputo. Do you think that you can rise to the occasion, at least for Mozambique, come the Africa Championships?
I have to rise to the occasion, Mark. Let me put it to you this way. The pressure will always be there. I have big shoes to fill. I mean, Maria Mutola is one of a kind. She's a legend in athletics in Mozambique, in the entire world, and I just have to make sure I keep putting Mozambique on the map.
That was Kurt Kuto, Mozambique's All Africa Games 400-meter hurdles bronze medalist, speaking in Tlokwe, Northwest Province, South Africa.
Thanks, Mark. And that report by Mark Ouma in Johannesburg brings us to the end of this edition of the Sunnyside Sports. I'm Douglas Mpoga sitting in for Sunny Young, who will be back tomorrow. Now back to you, Kim.
Okay, thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunnyside of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunnyside of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
In our feature segment, the third part of our series on alternative beliefs in South Africa. And next, undocumented children face deportation in immigration courts in the United States. But first, some music. Here is Patricia Majalisa of South Africa with Cool Down.
To what to do to the people.
Patricia Magalisa of South Africa would cool down.
Modern-day ghost hunters in South Africa's Gauteng province are investigating a series of supernatural events. These include manifestations of poltergeists, demons, and the restless spirits of the dead. The Gauteng Paranormal Society, or GPS, use high-tech equipment to investigate high-energy bundles to measure the presence and power of spirits. Darren Taylor reports in the third part of our series on alternative beliefs.
People eat, drink, and are merry at a restaurant in Pretoria, blissfully unaware that it's apparently haunted by two ghosts that terrify staff members cleaning up after hours. GPS case manager Taryn Willifier says the group's currently investigating if one of the entities is the dark spirit of a man killed in a fight at the venue when it was a bar many years ago. She says such probes are what she lives for.
Overall, it's very exciting, especially if we get, you know, evidence or something happens and we get energy that actually responds to us. It's an adrenaline rush. It really is, yeah. Especially if it's an outdoor thing, not a residential one. That's the best, you know, the graveyards and that type of thing, yeah.
The paranormal experts have also spent a lot of time at an abandoned hospital east of Johannesburg. Willifier says they found something on an audio recording they made at the site that they've so far not been able to explain.
It was a very loud, like a man that took in his breath. He went and then he blew it out, like, he went like that, and it was very creepy, you know. I had to listen to it a few...
At a private residence, a woman reported objects constantly moving around, seemingly by themselves. During the GPS on-site investigation, Willifier made another random audio recording and later played it when analysing the collected data.
And we were chatting, and in the background I heard like a very faint whistle. And I played it back to the owner the next time we were there, and she said her father used to hum that tune. So that's how we knew.
The evidence was used to establish that the spirit of the homeowner's deceased father was active in the house. At another suburban property, Willifier says an unidentified entity would touch children inappropriately.
If there were any children coming into the home, friends, this spirit would try and attack them, so to speak, especially if it was girls.
She says this case remains unsolved. The GPS is looking into supposedly paranormal events at De Deer, south of Johannesburg, following an incident here a few years ago. According to Willifier, a local farmer's teenage daughter would often disobey him to go on late-night motorbike rides with her boyfriend. The farmer then decided to do something to scare the couple.
So he had taken barbed wire and put it around the tree. One tree span it over the road and to the other tree, just to knock them off of the motorcycle. But it, unfortunately, when they were driving past that and didn't see it, it actually decapitated both of them.
Since the deaths, says Willifier, there have been frequent reports of supernatural activity near De Deer.
If you are on that road in the evenings, you'll see a ball of light coming up to that area and then just vanish. And some of our team members have seen it. There are some of public that I know have seen it. We've tried, we didn't get anything.
Willifier is concerned that more people are contacting her to report very physical paranormal incidents.
Things that happened, like people being pressed down on beds, scratch marks, cupboards opening by themselves. A lot of the things that come in to me seems very violent.
In her experience, says Willifier, people who report coming under physical attack from entities have often dabbled in Satanism or have played games in which they personally tried to contact the dead, both of which she describes as extremely dangerous.
You are opening yourself up, because with those types of things, you don't contact ghosts. It's demonic entities that come through.
But Willifier emphasizes that she and her fellow investigators are not afraid of ghosts at all when compared with the other dangers they face in crime-ridden Gauteng province.
We actually laugh. Like, if we want to go to a graveyard, we're more afraid of being hijacked than seeing a ghost, you know? That's the truth.
She says the GPS plans to buy more and better equipment to expand its investigations as it continues its quest to capture solid evidence of the paranormal. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Pretoria.
Growing numbers of undocumented children face deportation in immigration courts in the United States. They come as tourists from Central America, Europe, and Africa, but overstay their visas. U.S. laws offers them rights, but not lawyers. A New York law project called Safe Passage offers free attorneys to represent some of the youths. Lenine Benson, the founder, talks to VOA's Caroline Weaver in New York.
These young people are being celebrated at a fundraiser for Safe Passage, a project to provide children in immigration court with volunteer attorneys. Lenny Benson is the project's founder.
Last month, there was a three-year-old sitting in the deportation chair. You have a government prosecutor, you have a judge on the bench, and you have a child sitting with a translator, and in this case, a grandmother. And if the Safe Passage Project were not there, there would be no one standing up for that three-year-old or helping that grandmother navigate the court system.
Benson, a professor at New York Law School, spends at least one day a month in New York immigration court, and often many more, matching volunteer attorneys with child migrants.
Most of the young people we've met, there's a reason they don't want to go home. And that has been not just dire poverty, but real danger in their communities.
She says that while U.S. immigration law grants children special legal protections, it does not provide them lawyers to help secure those rights. Işık Basarır arrived from Turkey at age 15 and found Safe Passage only after a confusing search.
My sister obtained a green card, a couple of years after I got here, but she didn't have her citizenship back then, so she wasn't able to sponsor me or anything. But we did go to private lawyers to talk to them, we asked them if there's anything we could do, but they always said no, and I said there's no way.
Life is good over here and soccer's good too.
16-year-old Usman Berry came from Guinea at age 8. His parents are dead, and he lives with an uncle. Safe Passage lawyers won him legal residency, too.
And it means a lot because now I could, travel out and inside the country, and I could come back and go. So, I want to visit my country. I could go there and then come back.
Barry is one of a lucky few. Safe Passage and similar projects can help only a handful of all those in need as the numbers of unaccompanied child migrants surge. This year alone, the federal government predicts that more than 60,000 teens and children, most of them from Central America, will be apprehended at the U.S.-Mexican border.
That was Lennon Benson, founder of a New York law project called Safe Passage. He was talking to VOA's Caroline Weaver. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yeiz Wahib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
in a clear warning to both those in government and those leading rebel forces who are contributing or considering contributing to the terrible violence taking place in South Sudan. The United States has imposed sanctions on two individuals it has identified as committing or ordering human rights abuses or obstructing the peace process there. The U.S. Treasury Department announced May 6th that it was taking action against South Sudanese Major General Marielle Chenyong and Rebel Commander Peter Gadet, freezing any assets they may hold in the United States and barring U.S. citizens or companies from dealing with them. Chenyong, commander of the government's Presidential Guard, commanded troops that slaughtered hundreds of civilians in Juba when the conflict first erupted in December. Gadet, in turn, led the troops accused of the ethnically motivated killing of more than 200 civilians last month when rebel forces captured the town of Bentiu, capital of Unity State. The United States and others in the international community have long urged that those choosing violence in the South Sudan political crisis be held accountable. The sanctions initiative signals that the time for words is over and action is now due. Hopes have been raised that the violence may ebb with an agreement by South Sudan's government and the rebels to facilitate humanitarian assistance to civilians caught in the conflict and the upcoming meeting between President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar. This follows a high-level meeting between U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and President Kiir. Given yet another opportunity to end the destruction and death, the parties should seize the day and do everything in their power to resolve the political crisis and begin a process of national dialogue and reconciliation. The choices that government and opposition leaders face are stark and clear. The human costs of the conflict have been enormous and would likely grow if a settlement is not reached. There can be no military solution to the crisis, since what the parties are fighting to control would be destroyed. Before the promise of South Sudan's future is soaked in more blood, President Kiir and the opposition must work immediately for a true cessation of hostilities and move toward an understanding of the nation's future governance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.